The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, lovers of books. My name is Gary Kramer, and I'm a freelance writer for the Philadelphia Gay News and the City Paper and some other local publications. Chip Kidd was born in Reading, Pennsylvania, and attended Penn State, a school thinly disguised, well, not really disguised as much as just unnamed, in his debut novel, The Cheese Monkeys. Since Chip is visual, I'm going to do visual aid here. In this book, a student of graphic design takes classes by Winter Sorbeck, a brilliant but bullying design professor who bellows, "Good is dead." This message, that one's work needs to be extraordinary, not just ordinary, certainly resonates with Kidd. How else to acknowledge the elan with which the author-designer uses the lip of his bookbinding to thank his partner, his agent, mom and dad, Alfred A. Knopf, the Wilson High School marching band, and anyone who ever hailed him a cab? Yet Kidd, who describes writing as designing with words, is best known in the book world not for his words, but for his jacket and cover designs. He started working at Knopf in 1986, and over time has become so admired that authors now ask for him by name. His designs are a reflection of the designer, witty, playful, and often mischievous. I first met Kidd in the 1990s when I hired him to do a jacket design for Princeton University Press, and I followed his career closely ever since. His designs seamlessly mesh type with image, high culture with low, style with substance. From his fantastic appreciation of mythology, the DC Comics art of Alex Ross, to his superb and not in the least bit self-important portfolio book one, his contributions to publishing are illustrious. He recently was honored with an exhibition at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum. But his words are sharp and smart, too. Tonight, Chip Kidd is here to unwrap his new novel, The Learners. Again, a visual. Affectionately dubbed the book after The Cheese Monkeys, this title is set 4 years later at a New Haven advertising firm. The story has Kidd's alter ego hero named Happy getting involved with an experiment conducted by Yale professor Stanley Milgram. The episode, based on fact and memorably recreated in the book, involves a group of volunteers that are instructed to do, well, something sinister by a person in authority. And like the authority figure Winter Sorbeck, who taught Happy his potential in The Cheese Monkeys, Professor Milgram makes an indelible impression on the graphic designer. And with that thought, I would like to ask you to please join me in welcoming the impressive author and graphic designer, Chip Kidd, to the Free Library.
Well, thank you, everybody. It being Valentine's Day, I was worried that I was going to outnumber you. So in honor of the occasion, this is the first event on my book tour, which is going to go on for the next 2 months. You're all my guinea pigs, and in honor of Valentine's Day, I'm going to try and have my cake and eat it too tonight. I'm going to show some recent work visually, and then I'm going to show an experimental video that I made as a commercial for The Learners, and then I'm going to read a short passage from it. So I beg your indulgence. The title of my current lecture is this, and I'm often asked, I know there's a lot of design students in the audience, there usually is, and the question that I normally get is, Mr. Kidd, I'm a design student, I'm just starting out, what advice do you have for me? And usually the advice I have for them that I'd like to tell them is, take that piercing out of your nose. But that would be rude, so I can't say that. So what I say instead is there's two things that I've sort of learned in the last decade or so that have helped me become a better graphic designer. And one is teach yourself how to write. And the second is teach yourself how to do crossword puzzles. So the first thing, teaching yourself how to write, is, as he said in the introduction, writing is designing with words. It's another way to figure out how to design, which is how do you express an idea using 26 completely abstract little symbols that in and of themselves mean nothing. But when you put them together in the right combinations, they do mean something, and you can give them to another person, and they can look at them, and then they'll get, you know, all these images and sounds and smells and experiences just by seeing your combinations of these 26 abstract symbols. I think it's actually quite astonishing. Crossword puzzles then teach you how to manipulate that language and how to use it in a way that it maybe perhaps was not intended, but will also get your message across. So my favorite crossword puzzle is the New York Times crossword puzzle. And the way they do it, it's very interesting. Monday is easy, easy, easy. Anybody can do it. If you want to get started, start with a Monday. Tuesday, it's a little bit harder. Wednesday, it's harder than Tuesday. Thursday, it starts to get a little scary. And then Friday, it's like speaking another language. And then by Saturday, you need a mind that can bend spoons in order to figure out what they're talking about. So this is a Saturday clue, all right? So it's really, really hard. The clue itself is not hard. But we're going to play a little game throughout the short visual presentation. We got 10 letters for that clue. And I'm going to give you a hint that the answer begins and ends with A. Halfway through the visual presentation, we will I'll give you another clue. And then at the end, I'm going to ask you to try and guess what the answer is. So this is just a survey of some recent work. I've done book jackets for Oliver Sacks for many years now. He, of course, is the author of The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. He's a famous neurologist who has made a career out of these incredibly interesting stories about his patients. And his most recent book is about this. It's about music in the brain, how music works in the brain. And he had this problem because there was another book that had been written called Music in the Brain, so he couldn't call it that. This is rare for me that I have to design a cover for a book that doesn't have a title yet. But we know what it's about. And so I hire this illustrator, this wonderful guy named Christoph Niemann, and he does a lot of work for the New Yorker. We've been friends forever. And I said, just, you know, music in the brain, give me something. And he does this. And, you know, it's charming. I get it. It's a little bit too easy. It's a little bit too facile. And so I say, you know, keep going. And he gives me this, and I think this is more interesting because now we're not quite sure what it is until you get, you know, which is now going to be the subtitle of the book, which is Music in the Brain. So within the house, Knopf, where I work, we're trying to figure out what are we going to call this book, which is usually, that is strictly for the author to figure out, but the author can't figure it out, so we're trying to help him. And he comes up with this idea of musical hallucinations because one of his patients starts to hallucinate when he hears a certain kind of music. And so now I'm taking this illustration and I'm plugging it into a design. And, of course, the most important thing is this is Oliver Sacks' new book. So that's really what you see first. And then Sacks' assistant calls me and says, Oliver has this great title for the book. And it went something like, musical ditties, catchy tunes, musicophilia, and other phenomenon of music and the brain. And I just thought, That's not a title. That's a paragraph. That is about as uncatchy as it gets. And then I said something that I wouldn't have said had I not been working with Oliver Sacks for a long time. I said, you know, you've got a very interesting term in there. You know, what is musicophilia? And his assistant said, well, actually, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a term that he's coined in order to describe one of the phenomenons in his patient. And I said, that's a great title. You know, let's just call it musicophilia. And so she ran that by him, and he loved the idea. That almost never happens. The book jacket designers is not the one that's supposed to come up with the title of the book. That's the author's job. But in this case, I'd been working with him for so long that I was able to say that. The editor loved it. The editor-in-chief loved it. And then it was just a matter of how do we make this word, turn this word into music? All right. So now we have this, typographical solution. And our marketing department loves this, and it's got its own personality, but you can sort of figure out what it is, and it's very clear that it's by Oliver Sacks. So this is going to be the cover now, and we put this into the catalog, we present it at sales conference, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then literally about 3 weeks before the book is going to come out, which is like beyond the last minute in terms of book publishing, his author photos came in. And his assistant wrote me and said, these author photos are so great that we'd like you to consider them for the cover. And I said, all right. So she sent them to me, and I had to admit, I mean, I thought that it was pretty great. I mean, now you sort of, you get this emotional component to it. And it's very rare that in a book like this, you'd want to put the author on the front. But he's not just on the front, he's in a context. And he is swooning to Brahms or whatever he's listening to. And so we condense the typographic information. And this now becomes the cover. So it's about adapting. It's about adapting to the changes that can happen along in the process. And I remember one of our salespeople said that, this is perfectly nice, but it looks like Santa Claus is having an orgasm. To which I said, that can only help. And then this book then went on to become this huge surprise bestseller. It's still on the extended New York Times bestseller list. Came out last September. And I don't think that's really so much about the cover as it is about Oliver's fans really loving the book and really promoting it on the web. Augustine Burroughs is a very well-known writer. He's the author of Running with Scissors, which is his mega best-selling memoir of his dysfunctional childhood. I did not design the cover for that, but we had since become friends, and he insists that I do all of his book covers. So his last book of humorous essays was called This, and this is one of those cases where he calls me on the phone and says, you want to hear the title of the new book? And I said, yes. And he says this. And then, bing, I instantly know what I want to do for the cover. And he says, what? And I said, I'm not going to tell you. So what I want to do is I want to show him. I don't want to just describe it. And I use this photographer that I work very well with named Jeff Spear. And so we put an ad in the Village Voice for a very specific kind of hand model, right? And we get a lot of crank calls, but then we get the actual person to answer the ad, who actually was very legit. And he was thrilled because he doesn't get a lot of work as a hand model, actually. So this is his big break. And I sent it in to the publisher. This is a freelance job. And the art director said, the marketing people love it. And the reason they love it is because it's yellow and it has a hand on it. Now, most of the story I just told you is bunk. Jeff is a brilliant technician in what we call Photoshop, which all the students know what that is, but it's this photo manipulation program. And that's, you know, Jeff's hand, and he photographed it and then made it look like there's an extra finger on it. 3 weeks ago, Augustine emailed me, and he said, I got this fan letter and a picture from a woman who saw this book in a bookstore and practically broke down in tears because finally she found another person like her. And this is not a manipulation. This really is real. So immediately the authorities stormed the building and had her locked up as a genetic mutant. No, I'm just kidding. But that is really real. So we can touch lives with our book covers. Augustine's next book is going to be called this, and it's going to come out this summer. And with this book, he had a real problem because this is a memoir of his father, who was basically not very nice to him. And Augustine writes about these awful things, but with a sense of humor to kind of help you get through them. And there's nothing funny about this book at all. And when he talked to me on the phone about it, he said, you know, we're struggling with the title. This is the title we have. I'm not crazy about it, but let's just go forward for now. And really, he's very young in this book, and I think it's only from age, he's chronicling from age like 3 to 10 or 11, and then afterwards when he's a grown man. And I'm reading this thing, and it's very intense, and it's very riveting. And about halfway through, I got the idea for what the cover should be, and I finished the book to make sure I was right. And I was sure I was right. And this is the photographer Jeff Speer again working with me. And so now we're taking a very common domestic object and we're turning it into something scary, something that can hurt you. And that's the essence of this book. And Augustine just went over the moon for this. He's like, oh my God, you've made the title work. So thank you. And so this is coming out this summer. And this is going to be a real test for him because there are no laughs in this book whatsoever. And that's his stock in trade. Also, about 2 weeks ago, Augustine emailed me and he said, I just got the British cover of this book and I can't believe it. I can't believe how clueless they are. And I get this a lot, you know, like, what's the deal with British book covers? Now, not all British book covers are horrible, but this is sort of an example of what they just don't get. And I just wouldn't even really know where to start with this. But they're trying to make it look goofy, and it's not goofy at all. So this was as of 2 weeks ago. I don't know what they're going to do. He was going to kick and scream to get them to change it. The Road to the Road. I've been doing Cormac McCarthy's covers for years now since the... since All the Pretty Horses, and he has just been a dream to work with, or more accurately, not work with, because he just didn't really give me any input whatsoever other than nice cover. With this book, all of a sudden, he took an intense interest in what the cover was going to be. If you don't know, this is the story of a nameless father and son as they make their way through a post-apocalyptic United States, and they're sort of traveling basically through the South to try and get to the coastline where hopefully they will find some sort of civilization. And they're just struggling to survive. And it's a very bleak, it's beautifully written, but it's a very, very bleak book. And I wanted to show what they might see along the way, along their journey. And that's just simply it. That's what this is. It's a photograph by a wonderful photographer named Jason Fulford. Originally it was in color, and I converted it to black and white just to really bring home this sort of sense of what the book is. And Cormac, through his agent, this woman who also happens to be my agent on The Learners and for a lot of other writers, just did not like this. He thought it was too literal. It's too literal, she said, his agent. But Cormac has found this other picture that is just fabulous. And it's like, okay, this is a very strong picture. It's also one of the most famous pictures of the remains of the World Trade Center after 9/11 that ran in the New Yorker. They're in the South. And so I'm telling her all this on the phone, and she's like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah. So she says, well, he found this other picture that he wants you to use, and it's also really fabulous. Now, this is a dilapidated opera house in Havana from a very well-known book of contemporary Cuban photography. And I said to his agent, this is too far south. Plus, now Cormac has decided that he wants, he doesn't want his name or the title on the front of the book. And for this cover, he wants me to turn it on its side. So this is essentially what I'm being told to do. And because it's him, I sort of do it, but I've got to vet all this through our editor-in-chief, and who basically is getting angrier and angrier. Certainly not at me, but at what were sort of these hoops that are being held up that we are being forced to jump through. So he's on the phone to the agent screaming at her, what the hell is he thinking? He's crazy and you know, blah, 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 blah. Then she gets on the phone to me and she says, well, you know, this book is actually about Cormac's bitter divorce from his third wife, and he's going to lose their little boy to her custody, and that's what the book is about. And I'm thinking, well, that really doesn't help me a whole lot, other than explain why he's so obsessed with it. And so I decided to try and do this sort of, like, very stark black hole, basically, so that you can see what the book is as soon as you see it. And his name is black on black, basically. So it's a very sort of glossy jacket but his name is in matte. So it's there if you want to see it, but not there if you don't want to see it, because he doesn't want to see it. And this kind of solved it for everybody. Like, he signed off on it, and our marketing department thought it was okay. And the really interesting thing about it is when you went into a bookstore and saw it amongst all this other stuff that was all busy and trying to get your attention, this was literally the black hole that just, like, sucked your eye right in. And the book did very well. But, of course, it didn't do nearly as well until herself decided that she liked it. And so then we go, bling. Aww. And, of course, now the whole design scheme goes to hell in a handbasket. And essentially now it says, Oprah's the road. But, you know, we just sort of, you know, ride along with that. We love Oprah, and her literal stamp of approval meant that we literally sold, like, 2 million more copies of this than we would have. And she had him on her show, and it was very interesting and wonderful. So then, again, it sounds like I'm making this up. A couple of weeks ago, somebody writes me and says, I just saw the French version of Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which, by the way, went on to win the Pulitzer Prize, which also didn't hurt. And again, you know, what are these Europeans thinking? Yikes. You know, it's the Pulitzer Prize by Cormac McCarthy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. We don't know what they're thinking. It's often assumed, because I've achieved a certain level of success, that everything I do sails right through, and I never get anything rejected, or I never get any problems with the publisher, I never get anything, you know, refused or whatever. Bunk. This happens all the time. It doesn't matter who you are or how much stature you have. Publishing is crazy enough that if they don't like what you're doing, they will tell you. And this is not altogether a bad thing, except when I think they are wrong. I'm just going to show a couple examples of this. Now, this is a very peculiar novel. It's a freelance job. It's not a Knopf book, but it's about a group of vampires who work at a news magazine program on network television, not unlike 60 Minutes. And it's about their day-to-day lives and loves as vampires, working in network broadcasting and falling in love and discovering their inner selves and et cetera, et cetera. This is a stupid book. It's dumb. This is a dumb idea. People often ask me, do you ever turn down books because you disagree with their moral content or you feel that they're not very good and you don't want to be associated with them? Rarely. I think this is a totally moronic book, and reading 20 pages of it just absolutely sealed the deal. It's stupid, but I have an idea for it, so I'm going to take it on. And of course, my idea is, okay, I'm a young and up-and-coming vampire in network broadcasting, and I meet, you know, this other woman vampire in network broadcasting that I want to ask out on a date, and we go out on a date. And, of course, one thing leads to another, and we go back to her place, and you just think, okay, baby, I don't want to, you know, like, chew your neck up, so I'm just going to put the fangs in here while we get busy. And, you know, and, of course, then I made it red, which makes it instantly very, very appealing. And again, Jeff shot this, and you got all the nice bubbles on the fangs, and this is great. And I send it into the publisher, and they hate it because it's not scary enough, upon which I say, you're scaring me. And that's the end of that. Okay, now, this is a different novel by Michael Chabon, which you may have heard of, The Yiddish Policeman's Union. This novel embraces the concept that the Jews, after World War II, did not settle in Israel, but instead settled in Sitka, Alaska. And I'm reading this thing, and Chabon is so skilled that about 60 pages into it, I started to think, that is fascinating. I didn't realize the Jews settled in Sitka, Alaska. Who knew? So here's the difference between a really terrific writer and a stupid one. This is a potentially stupid book, but Chabon is so good that it completely works. And the whole concept is, like, what if Sam Spade was, you know, this fallen Hebrew scholar who's become a private eye in Sitka, Alaska, and this murder happens on page one, and he's trying to solve it, and he's in a downward spiral and blah, blah, blah. So I decided to do, I had a concept for it, and so I did a drawing. And the idea is basically you're in Sitka, Alaska, and it's 2 a.m. and you, hello, who is it? It's the police, open up. And so you would see that. And Chabon loved it. The publisher hated it because they said it looks like a comic book, which hits home. And Chabon, this is his first book with this new publisher, and he didn't want to fight this particular battle. So that got killed. But I have to say, with all due respect, the cover that they did go with was very beautiful, although to me it looked like a comic book. But anyway, it's all right. All right, so here is our hint in the middle of the visual lecture. These are all of the vowels in the clue, all right? So you sort of wrap your head around that and remember what the clue is, and we'll get the answer soon. I'm usually against what I would call a literal interpretation on a cover of what a book is. This was an exception. This literally is a big sort of coffee table book's length of interviews with Woody Allen of his films throughout his career. And so I wanted to turn the cover itself into a conversation. And that seemed pretty obvious to me, a way to do that. And this is a Knopf book, so I'm dealing with the editor directly, and I took this cover up to him, and he said, well, I think this is very clever, but my problem is you've broken the title up. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the title is Conversations with Woody Allen, and now I don't know what the title is when I look at this. And I'm thinking, well, maybe you're a moron, but I can't say that, and he's not a moron. He's one of our best editors. I'm just reminded, even though I've been at Knopf for 22 years now, that editors, by and large, are very verbal people. That is why they are editors. And when he looks at this, all he can see is that the title is Conversations with Woody Allen, and now that's unclear. So instead of trashing this and starting over, I took a chance and realized that all I had to do was this. And now it works for him. And it's a very strange lesson to learn, because you would think, well, what's the difference? And, formally, there is no difference. It's still two people having a conversation, but now, in his mind, the title is intact, and that makes it valid. So it's really about getting to know who you're working with and what's going to work for them, and how to basically save a concept instead of having to throw it away. I'm a great comics fan. I did the first posthumous assessment of Charles Schulz's art called Peanuts, The Art of Charles M. Schulz. I worked closely with his widow and with his surviving sons. And that came out in, I believe, fall of 2001 and did very well. At the same time, I knew that this writer, David Michaelis, was working on the definitive prose biography of Schulz. And he had done, his previous book was on N.C. Wyeth, and Schulz worshipped the Wyeths. And that was what he aspired to be, and in his mind never became anything nearly as great as them. So the Schulz family sort of gave themselves over to David Michaelis to write this book, and for 5-6 years he did. And he's the real deal. I mean, he did all the research and found out a ton of stuff that nobody knew. So it was a big love fest with the family until a little more than a year ago, he delivered the 900-page manuscript of this biography to his widow and to his children to read, basically as a courtesy. Like, legally they couldn't make him change anything, but he wanted his facts checked. And so they read this thing, and they sort of freaked out. Now, in the meantime, he wants me to do the cover. So I decided, all right, I did my one visual spin on Schulz. Now I want to do a different one that's appropriate to this book, which is to basically distill down the essence of Schulz's art. And that was this way, which is to take, okay, we're talking about abstract symbols again, like the alphabet. But here are 6 completely abstract symbols that in and of themselves mean nothing, but in this combination come together to make this entire emotional life that we've all come to know. And that's his signature. And I thought, this is going to work on so many levels. You're going to be able to see this at 50 paces in a bookstore and know instantly exactly what it is. Michaelis loved it. In the meantime, Schulz's widow and the surviving children are at war both with Michaelis and with each other. Some of the children thought the book was terrific and basically told it like it was. The others thought, no, this makes him sound like he's too much of a depressive weirdo. It's too sad. He was a happy person. Why isn't he more happy in the book? And et cetera, et cetera. And all of this eventually came out in the reviews. So what they tried to do ultimately was they tried to put a legal stop on the book. They tried to get it basically pulled so it could be reworked. And David is very smart, and he had all the legal stuff in place in order to keep the book on track and published last fall, because what he does so brilliantly in this book is he interweaves strips within the text so that you can see what's happening in the strip which corresponds to what was happening in Schultz's life. And he was terrified because he, you know, if they found a way to legally pull the strips, the book just was not going to work the way it was supposed to work. So he won that battle. The battle he lost was that I, as a designer, was not legally able to use any Schultz imagery on the front or his signature. And so, which as a designer, that forces you to think, but also as a Peanuts fan, it forces you to think. So now what are we going to do? What can we do that's going to communicate instantly what this book is, the way this does, that will wriggle free of the legal problems involved? And the answer was this. And if you're a Peanuts fan, you know that Charlie Brown has his iconic yellow jersey with the black zigzag band going through it. And you can't copyright a black zigzag bar on a yellow background. And while this looks like his handwriting, it's actually not. It's a licensed typeface from AGFA that's simply called comic strip, that looks like comic strip writing. And that was our solution. And Michaelis said that he actually ultimately liked this better. Personally, I disagree. I like the other one because I think it has a stronger emotional impact. But this is how the book went out. And, of course, it did very well and got very widely reviewed. Okay, so I get this question ever since I've been writing novels, starting with The Cheese Monkeys and now The Learners. People ask me, "Oh, you know, what's it like to design a book cover for yourself?" and et cetera, et cetera. And with this one, I came upon a scheme pretty early on because four years ago, I was asked by USA Today if I wanted to serialize a piece of writing I was working on their website in a program called Open Book. And I said yes because I could take part of the learners and do it as it forced me to write a portion of it. There's these Milgram experiments, and I figured out in seven installments I could serialize the Milgram experiments, which would help me to write it. As a writer, the more structure I give myself, not the easier it is, but it just helps enable it to get done. So the thing that cracked me up was, and I get this question, you're like, well, with e-books, are book jackets going to disappear? I didn't even think about this, but once all this was in place, the USA Today people said, we need a cover for it to run with the serialization online. And I said, why? It's online. I said, we just need it. We need this visual tag. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to think about this sooner rather than later. And I decided to start with the work of my friend and colleague, Charles Burns, Philadelphia's finest cartoonist, and he was working on his book Black Hole at the time, and that's what this is from. And I zeroed in on the gentleman in the upper right corner. I needed that sense literally of shock in someone's face, but I wanted to also obscure part of it so that you're getting enough information to know that something is literally alarming. Something is wrong. Something is frightening or scaring this person. But then the typography takes over and sort of like acts as visual cues. And so this is what ran on USA Today. And then when it came time last summer to start seriously thinking about the actual cover of the book, I basically wanted to keep this scheme, but then I started to rethink how the type should work. And so to get the people at Scribner, my publisher, on board with it, I switched it so that my name is cueing the eyes, the title of the book becomes the nose, and it's centered in it. And then the Cheese Monkeys blurb becomes this sort of, you know, that stays where it was. It becomes this kind of silent scream And so they liked this a lot. In fact, they actually liked it too much because they said, because I said to them, this is just the basic idea, but it's, I'm going to rework it so it's better. And they're like, no, 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 we like this. Don't touch it. Don't touch it. Just keep it like this. And I'm saying, no, you have to trust me. I'm not going to make this worse. I am going to make it better. I'm going to hire Charles Burns to do a custom drawing for this, and I'm going to hire my friend Chris Ware to do the lettering by hand. So that is unique to this book. So I'm a terrible draftsman. This is my sketch for Charles Burns, and I do perhaps narcissistically want this drawing to be me. With these glasses, I have these glasses custom made by a firm in England because I love the Bauhaus and blah blah blah. So it's like, okay, this is what we're going on now, and I'm sending Charles this, and I'm sending him this is a self portrait taken in my apartment. We haven't quite figured focus out yet, but I know. I mean, I've known and worked with Charles for so long that he is a genius. He is a brilliant draftsman, and so he sends me back these pencils, and I know, you know, like, yes, this is it. This is, you know, this is perfect. So he goes to inks, and we go to inks, and there they are, and so on the front, I want this startled, screamy expression. And then on the back, I want the opposite. Basically, part of the plot is giving people electroshocks and shock, you know, horribly shocking them. So I also want, you know, the sense that it's not just about being open, it's about being closed. And then we go for the shock. And then this is Chris doing this wonderful thing that he can do. You know, in a certain way, getting a genius like Chris Ware to just do your lettering for you is kind of ridiculous. I mean, it's like getting Frank Lloyd Wright, you know, to build you a doghouse or something. But anyway, but, you know, this is exactly what I want. It's like beautiful script that, you know, nobody can do this anymore. And you can't get this on a computer font. So here's the pencil in place with how it's going to work. Chris gave me an alternate which I liked, which was a little more abstract. And there that is, and now the thing's in place, and the sort of peekaboo nature of the jacket, which you've probably seen, is that we're going to go to this shock machine that is used in these experiments. So I give Charles this for reference to build the machine, but of course the needle's in the wrong place. The needle has to be over to the right, and it is colored red in the final thing. So when you take the cover off and you think you're going to get the mouth, you get this other thing instead, which is sending you a certain kind of visual message. And then on the back is that, along with the quotes and people saying things about it. So that's the cover of The Learners. Now, has anybody figured out the answer to our crossword clue? Starts with A, ends with A. Okay, so here's the thing. I very purposefully did not verbally articulate this clue because in your head it probably says a number of people. But of course, that's not what they're intending. They're tricking you. It's a number of people. Something that numbs you. And this is the way you have to think when you're doing a Saturday crossword puzzle, and it forces you to reconsider language about how we pronounce it, about what we intend it to mean, about what the multiple meanings it can have. And it's a wonderful sort of mental exercise, you know, for me. And often, you know, I don't get through the Saturday puzzles, but it's fun to at least try. All right. So what you're about to see now, I hope will not frighten or disgust you too horribly. I've been experimenting with video. I wanted to make a commercial for The Learners. And so I filmed this thing on Saturday with this wonderful director that I've been working with. And I gave him the storyboard, and this is what I want to do. And this is meant to be posted on YouTube, which it will be eventually. It's not perfected yet. There's lots of imperfections in it. But it's when I'm talking both in the Cheese Monkeys and in the Learners, I'm talking about form and content. The form is what something appears to be, and the content, though, is what it's actually saying. And so I used to give this assignment in school of doing an impression. This is what it means to do an impression, and I mean like a jokey vaudeville impression of somebody. But if you take, you know, if you can sound like somebody, but they're saying something that they would never say or were never meant to say, it forces you to re-examine how form and content work together. So this is what I'm trying to convey, and I know it's going to seem odd, but it will be over very quickly.
The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leadeth me to lie in pastures green. Yes, temperatures rise inside my sugar walls. My sugar walls.
Kids, are you real? We'll lose yourself in the music the moment. You want it? You better never let it go. You only get one shot. Mary, I love you, but this trailer's got to go.
No, my name isn't Baby. It's Helen. Miss Hayes, if you're nasty.
So that soundtrack is this band that I formed with my friend Marco, and the sound mix isn't right yet. So the music's way too soft, and the other's way too loud. So that's a work in progress. All right, so to speak. So now, with what little time we have left, I'm going to do a short reading from The Learners. I don't know how many people here have read The Cheese Monkeys. Ooh, good. All right. So basically, this is Happy and Himilzi meeting again, and it's been 3 years. And Happy now he's relocated to New Haven, Connecticut. He's got this job at an ad agency, and he knows that Himilzi lives nearby. And he's settled in for a couple of weeks, but he hasn't made any effort to contact her yet. And lo and behold, he sort of runs into her. It's a Saturday. He's at an art store buying some art supplies when he hears a very familiar voice.
So what you're telling me is you lost my rhinoceros head. Is that what you're telling me?
By the beginning of July, things were going pretty well, so I guess it was inevitable. Himilzi Dodd chose then to come back into my life in her own special way.
You said importing it through you guys would be no problem. That's a $300 rhinoceros head, pal. They don't grow on trees.
Now, some of you might be wondering why I haven't mentioned her before. There are many reasons, but for those who are unfamiliar, she tends to take over whenever she's involved.
Or, as she once put it, quote, I am the corpse at every wedding. I am the bride at every funeral. 3 centuries, buddy. Cough him up. We'd met my freshman year at State. She was a junior. I was captivated. And she was, too. At least, that's what she led me to believe. Together, we went through an art school boot camp, the likes of which neither of us expected, and we came out of it booted. Me, out of every preconception about art and design that I ever had, and she, from sanity, and the school altogether. Our parting was not an easy or coherent one, chiefly because of what I'd perceived over the phone to be her total nervous breakdown, which I admit I played a part in, however unwittingly. For Hamilzi, living dangerously was the only way to live. And me, I'm practically a crossing guard. More than once, I'd spoiled her fun, rescuing her from something she didn't want to be saved from. And who is ever forgiven for that? I was her unwanted conscience, the Jiminy Cricket to her Pinocchio, forever doing her good turns. For that alone, I suppose she had every right to hate me. Then, nothing. No contact for the next 3 years, but she was never far from my thoughts from the moment of our first meeting. What do you mean, we know where it is? I know what that means. On Earth. Somewhere between here and the tiny, tiny Republic of Togo. Jesus. Here's what I did know, long before I ever came to Connecticut. Hamilzi had grown up just 20 minutes away in Guilford, and her family still lived there. They were listed. I'd mused that with any luck, she might even still be living with them, and I had an eye on getting in touch once I got my feet on the ground, as it were, once I got the nerve. And now the nerve had gotten me. Enough of you. Where's your supervisor? She turned and finally saw me standing in the checkout line of the campus art depot, clutching 6 jars of fluorescent egg tempura to my chest on a summer Saturday afternoon. Neither of us could believe it. Our eyes met, vaporizing 3 years in 3 seconds. Oh, my God. Her face hadn't changed. It was Betty Boop meets Cute with the Dragon Lady. Ditto her figure, size 0 in a sleeveless linen cocktail dress the color of dried mustard, a tiara of Ray-Ban sunglasses perched over her forehead, mascara applied with a trowel and a shaky hand. I replied, a reflex. Since when, she started, staggering towards me, her eyes dark with horrified concern, since when have you been painting with fluorescent colors? Since when, I countered, leaving the queue, do you have a rhinoceros head? I don't have it. Haven't you been paying attention? The simpletons in charge of this salvage sale have lost it. She clicked her tongue in disgust. Can you imagine? It's the size of a large dwarf and weighs 200 pounds. It's like losing the front end of a DeSoto. The manager eased towards her cautiously. Ma'am, I keep telling you, it's not lost. It's just being held in customs. Oh, I thought, you poor man. You have no idea who or what you're dealing with. Customs? What? Are they waiting for the rest of it to show up? Miss Dodd, I said calmly, science has shown us that the severed rhinoceros head is the breeding ground of choice for the notorious and deadly tsetse fly. One nostril alone could comfortably house an entire colony. Surely this would be of grave concern to our government. The manager gaped at me, desperate with gratitude for any explanation, however ridiculous. Yes, that's it exactly. She shouldered her slate Chanel purse and smoothed her ebony Lulu helmet of hair. You were always like that, she sneered at me, always. What, right? I said. No, infuriating. Her scowl melted into a sly grin, and she made for the door, pausing to address the manager. I'll be back in a week, and that head had better be here, or I'll have yours. And, jerking her lovely head in my direction, out she went. I hastily abandoned the paint jars to the nearest shelf and followed, as I did in the old days. My whole body was smiling. Himilzi, you're here. You're really here. The proprietors of Pepe's Pizza on Wooster Street boldly claim that they, and only they, originated this most ubiquitous of delectations here in the United States, and more specifically in New Haven. Which may or may not be true, but this much is indisputable. They are not open for lunch. Dinner only, those bastards. So Himilzi agreed, proclaimed actually, that we go to Modern a Pete's, Pepe's biggest rival in town for the crust crown. They start serving at noon. Besides, it's better, she said, gunning the engine of her Corvair. The sauce has more tang. Everyone's afraid to say it. The "but not me" went unsaid. It always did. I was still in kind of a shock. Were I to wake up in my bed in the next second, Himilzi gone like a smoke ring, I would not have been surprised. But there she sat, as real as 3 years ago when we used to cruise down College Avenue, head scarcely clearing the dashboard, lacquered ebony fingernails orbiting the stick shift, the world behind her, racing past, ever trying to keep up with her. God, Himilzi, if there's a word for how much I've missed you, it's not in my vocabulary. Stop staring at me. I'm not the Hottentot Venus, she said. I'm sorry. It's just that. And what happened to your neon paint? Lose your nerve? I put it on hold. Something came up. Did it. And that would be the human equivalent. She chuckled dryly, pulled over onto State Street and into a spot across from the restaurant. After she turned the engine off, she hesitated and chortled, "You mean inhuman, darling." Thank you. So we will do some Q&A if people want to. Right, okay. Just one or two questions. You could also ask questions online signing if you'd like. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sort of preempted by when a book becomes a movie, and then what happens to the original cover, or do they have
gets
a dual
flushed cover? Down the toilet?
I mean,
this is what we call a movie tie-in, and it doesn't happen to me that much because I mostly work in hardcover books, and by the time this happens, the books are in paperback. You just sort of roll with it. You have no control over it whatsoever. My favorite story about this was that I did a cover for a book called The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje, and that got made into a very well-known movie with Ralph Fiennes and Kristin Scott Thomas. And so then there was this big movie edition cover of it. And they sort of rode that out, and then the bookstores complained because they liked the original cover so much, and so they went back to the original cover for it. So I thought that was nice, but there's really nothing you can do about that. Okay, thank you. Yeah. Whew. Hope that was okay.
No, it went well. I think it's just one thing to be aware of in the future might just be that, you know, you might be tight for time, so
yeah.
That's the only thing.
Yeah.
And you were right not to include the McInerney.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.